Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamson and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday, March 11th, 2018.
And we're on the road.
Again.
Again.
This time in...
Santa Monica, California.
Right. Visiting...
Zeke and Noel.
Okay. Zeke Abuhoff.
Zeke, yes. The
And Noel Borg.
Our youngest son, Noel Borg, his buddy. And...
Hi, Mom. Hi, Pam.
Noelle's blinking out a message. Zeke, say something so people know you're here.
I don't know what happened to my seltzer. I had a seltzer.
Zeke's focused. All right. So we're going to start with telling you a little bit about our weekend. We're having a fabulous weekend here in Santa Monica, which we find, believe it or not, to be a beautiful and interesting place.
Well, it's our first trip to Santa Monica.
It is.
Right. And Zeke and Noel have been living here for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
Almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we finally made it out to check out their accommodations.
And they're fabulous.
Yeah. Although the weather has not been typical of Southern California.
It's been raining. Well, I don't know what's typical.
It's been raining most of the time.
If it rains every day, it's typical. It's been rainy and kind of chilly, but now the sun's out. And we're beginning to see what Southern California is all about.
Right. So we've been exploring
and
eating like crazy.
Eating like crazy. It's been walking and eating. It's like a forced march from one restaurant to another. And we're about to resume that march.
And we have strolled by the beach. We have been bike riding by the beach.
We've been all over the place. We've seen every inch of Santa Monica. I don't know what we're going to cover tomorrow. But we're having a great time. The food's great. And when we pick up the paper today, and they have an article about a place that's right next to where we were walking just this morning. They're celebrating the bread in Venice, California, of all places.
Yes. We were actually in Venice.
Yeah.
We went by Muscle Beach, right, Zeke?
Mm-hmm.
But there was not a lot of activity.
No, seemed like an off day for Muscle Beach due to inclement weather.
Inclement weather. So, but we should hear from you guys. We should say that previously, Noel and Zeke lived in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a sense or two, how do you compare the two places?
This place is a lot warmer.
Okay.
I think that's the biggest difference. I think because it's California, because it's L.A., and there's an L.A. to New York coastal elite situation happening, there's a lot of similar things. So we took them today to Abbot Kinney, which is very similar to Soho, I think, in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of...
With pricey boutiques.
Oh, yeah.
And,
and it does feel like every place we go to eat feels like the place we used to go in Brooklyn with you folks, including standing online. For 25, 30 minutes, which is something we don't have as much in New Jersey. But we were talking last night, Zeke, about the difference in the places. And it sounded like Williamsburg at least had a different social vibe, or maybe a clearer social vibe in terms of people. The bars are lively or that sort of thing with young people. Or am I wrong about that?
It did a little bit. I mean, to me, there are a bunch of connected issues with how this area works. In terms of like how it feels to be around here. So like, for example, you mentioned the bars in Brooklyn. There's a pretty clear and popular bar culture. There are lots of bars of various styles for various subcultures. If you're a young person, you've got lots of options, and you can usually pretty easily take the train and walk to all these different options. Here, the train system not nearly as extensive, and that affects how this stuff gets laid out. At least that's how it seems to me. So you have like maybe some neighborhoods where there are pockets of nightlife clustered around each other, but also you have just individual destinations kind of spread miles apart so that you don't have this feeling of, oh, we're going to go out on the town and just, you know, hit up five places in three blocks. Instead, it's all about going to a particular destination. So when that affects how the social scene works, to say, I'm making a plan, I'm going this one place, I'm going to drive, 20 minutes to get there and meet my friend. Or we're going to have to like hire an Uber to do it so we can have, so we can drink, all that stuff. That affects how people do stuff. So I think as a result, people here don't stay out as late. I think that
bars close at two as well. So instead of 4 a.m. in New York.
Well, I know that's the that's when the magic happens between 2 and 4 a.m.
Exactly.
You know,
and there's more people exercising here. I think there's more pressure to be thin and more exercise culture in L.A.
Yes, people aren't drinking beers at 2 a.m. They're saying like, oh my gosh, I've stayed out too late already. I've got yoga early in the morning.
Now it's sounding like
and that affects that affects
well,
my beers. But it's still good. It's still fun.
People don't party in LA.
Not
they party so much harder in Brooklyn.
Well, the other thing is this: you it's a car culture, and then you put your finger on it. And then Zeke and Amal don't have a car; they went instead with the electric bicycle, which has its limitations, but it's still a lot of fun. You cover a lot of ground, but I guess at night or in inclement weather, it's a little bit limiting. So you got to have a car. Although we have found Uber here is unbelievable. We've taken some long trips. And it's much cheaper here than it is in the metropolitan area in New York, and it's really an option.
Yeah, yeah. Car sharing in general. We've been using a lot of Lyft recently, and it's much cheaper than it is in New York, and it makes that way of getting around more realistic.
Yeah. It's a magical.
So, am I allowed to talk about bread?
Yeah, sure.
So, the New York Times did have an article in the travel section today about bread in Venice, California. And it was funny because there was the sense of, maybe people in L.A. won't even eat bread because they're so sort of health and appearance conscious. And but no, there's some great bread coming about, cropping up. Specifically, cite one particular place that we rode our bikes by, the Rose Cafe. Mm-hmm. And they also mentioned an interesting thing about some of these more artisanal breads, that perhaps the way the bread is made actually kind of activates or, what would you call it, eliminates the gluten. And so that they have one baker saying in particular, Mr. Caden, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. He says, he remarks that these breads, which break down the gluten, that was the word I was using for, he ends up converting many gluten-phobic customers. Without jumping down their throat, we say, maybe it's not a problem. Maybe, meaning the gluten, maybe it's white flour or bread from the supermarket, which is not really bread at all.
Well,
but anyway, we have seen some beautiful breads,
beautiful
pastries.
The food's been really good.
Around here. And the article kind of sums up by saying, apparently people in L.A. are willing to eat bread. They will eat anything that's actually good, perhaps.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Maybe gluten doesn't come from a store.
Oh, here we go.
Maybe bread means a little bit
okay.
more.
Okay, a Grinch reference for those wondering. There was an article in the Journal, since Tanz I've been doing so much traveling, which sort of hit home, which is the notion of surprise travel. Surprise travel is this. Surprise travel is you sign up with a company. The company says, we'll make all the arrangements, pay your money, you write a big check, you show up at the airport, and you receive an envelope, and they say, okay, you are going to blank. The example they gave is Chicago. And your bags are packed. You were told enough that you're appropriately packed, I hope. And then you're headed to Chicago and they have a plan for you. And you are going to be surprised one day after another because they've got it all laid out with some free time. And the question is, how does that sound? How does that sound, Noel?
I mean, it sounds like I have my own ideas of trips that I want to take. And it's hard to get time off and it costs a lot of money to travel.
Yeah.
It's not something I would pay for.
Okay.
It seems like the kind of thing, like, I'm just so bored of traveling.
but it's supposed to be an antidote to the, excessive over-planning. I know exactly where I want to go. I've always wanted to go here. I'm going to do this, this. And then just, putting these notches on your travel belt.
Right.
And maybe the idea of the spontaneity of somebody else making the decision and sending you off to these places allows you to, enjoy more thoroughly the adventure.
Yeah.
Of course, Daniel doesn't have this problem. He always travels this way.
Exactly.
He pretty much shows up at the airport and says, Tamsin, where are we going?
Exactly. The king of oblivion. And I'll tell you, I endorse this.
You're sold. You're sold.
I have no expectation. To wake up in the morning, what are we doing today? We're going X. So then we go on these bike trips and we both benefit from that.
I was
going to
say the bike trips that you go on, that's something that almost seems like a better alternative to this, in the sense that
right.
you know where you're going, you know the type of experience you're
right.
getting, but all the dumb details are taken care
right.
of. And to some extent, like, there are little surprises along the way.
Right.
So I think that would kind of address Noelle's concern, in a sense that you wouldn't show up saying, okay, I've blocked off part of my schedule, this is a big commitment for me, and then they say, and you're going to Nowheresville. You're going somewhere you never wanted to be. You're doing stuff you never wanted to do. Instead, you are going to do something that you want to do, but you still get to wake up and say, oh, we're doing that today? Oh,
right.
Great.
And it's not something that we've necessarily researched to death or planned or have invested in. There's no pressure. If it was my decision, it was Tam's decision. So, so I think to that degree, the level of surprise is useful.
I go back to the thing that we don't always know what we will enjoy the most.
That's true.
Bike restaurants, trips, movies,
yeah.
trips, everything.
But there is that element.
Lots of times you've been dreaming about this place
yeah.
and it doesn't pan out, and something totally out of left field works for you.
But that's the bike trip too, because the bike trip is going with a bunch of people you don't know. And it's not like you planned it to the nth degree and you're just going with people that you know will travel well with you. You're saying, hey, I'll meet new people, I have new experiences. So I think Zeke's right. I think it does work. All right. So there was an article in the paper, too, about something I didn't know about, but Tamsin tells me everyone on the planet knows about, which is Halo Top ice cream.
Yes.
Halo Top ice cream. And Noelle, what is Halo Top ice cream?
Halo Top ice cream is a low-calorie, high-protein ice cream that people are excited about because they can eat the whole pint.
Eat the
right.
whole pint.
So if you eat a pint of Häagen-Dazs, how many calories does it have?
1,160 calories.
But if you eat the Halo Top,
it is
360.
Or
so
less.
That seems
or
like
less.
A
wow.
big savings.
That is, it's an unbelievable deal. And
but my
no mathematician,
is it
right?
Ice
that's
cream,
a 6,000%
is it ice cream?
Is it
so the owner of the Salt and Straw, which is a Portland-based company, but we actually went to today in Venice, California.
In Venice, California. That's the connection. I hope everyone hears that connection. Yeah.
Says it's not ice cream. And I actually agree with that. I feel like if you're going to sit down and have dessert, as opposed to kind of mindlessly eating something that feels like a dessert.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was such a thing, but apparently everybody, when they buy a pint of ice cream, sits down and eats the whole thing. That it's a real risk. And some people don't buy pints of ice cream for that reason. So, I mean, who knew?
Who knew? But Noelle's point, it doesn't sound like it is exactly what we think of an ice cream. And you and Noelle discussing before, Tim, so that it has a lot of chemicals in it and artificial sweeteners that you might want to avoid.
It has some non-sugar sugars with various, from various sources, like stevia,
yeah.
right?
It's kind of like decaf coffee. It's like you're sitting down and you like the idea of the ice cream, maybe, as opposed to the actual...
Right.
Well,
maybe not again.
What did that one gal say about it?
Oh, quantity over quality.
That's your motto, quantity over quality. Well, Zeke, you're a quantity over quality guy.
No, I wouldn't say so. I feel for these poor people who are in ice cream purgatory. They want to have delicious ice cream. They're almost having delicious ice cream, but then they hold back. They get this thing, oh, no, it's a little different. Oh, it's really about me working out or eating well or something like that. But they're not even necessarily achieving that. It's not like you eat this ice cream and you become amazing looking or something.
Yeah.
So now they're still stuck feeling guilty because they snuck some ice cream. It's just like, look, eat the ice cream and enjoy it, or go to the gym and do that. Don't
pull
yourself
around.
All right,
you're an all-or-nothing guy. Well, they're selling
a
lot of
it's ice cream, but we know it's only 300
calories.
They're
selling a lot of this stuff.
And you can eat a pint of it if that's what you're looking for.
All right, so now we have a museum update, and we have a big
museum
update.
Ding, ding, ding,
ding,
ding,
ding,
ding.
Always
ding.
A popular feature among the museum
Well, I mean,
powers.
The first thing we should get out of the way is back at the good old Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, back home. There apparently was a big protest on Saturday, led by the photographer Nan Golden. And it was in the Sackler wing. Nan and a bunch of protesters actually put up a banner saying, "Shame on Sackler, fund rehab," and threw yellow pill bottles with white labels that read OxyContin and "prescribed to you by the Sacklers" into the wing's reflecting pool. And so the protesters all laid down at a certain point, did kind of a die-in, and then the security managed to get them up, and they marched through the museum shouting, "Sackler's lie, people die."
Right.
And then eventually made it outside. Nan Golden announced on the steps of the Metropolitan, "We're just getting started. We'll be back."
I'm sure.
And the whole idea is not so much, it's not a protest against the Met, really. It's a protest against the Sacklers, who were owners of Purdue Pharmaceuticals, responsible for making OxyContin. And Golden was herself addicted to OxyContin for a number of years, and getting off it was one of the darkest moments of her life.
And I'm sure the Met never knew what hit it.
But they chose the Met because of the possibility of the notoriety, et cetera. So that's what's going on at the Met.
That's great at the Met.
Okay,
but we were at a different museum this week.
Yes, we went to the Getty Center,
right?
And I've never been there. And it was extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
We had a terrific time. It opened in 1997.
We should say it's in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
Yes, just reminding people on the West Coast.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And it's very interesting architecture with a lot of terraces and interesting sort of succulent gardens and trees and outdoor sculptures. And so we wandered around. It was pretty crowded. You park at a certain point and then you take a tram the rest of the way. We had a good time. A lot of stuff was going on there. There was singing, there was dancing, there was a photo booth set up. It was had a lot of bells and whistles. But paintings themselves, the paintings that we looked at, the sculptures, etc., were quite interesting. Noelle, what did you like best that you saw?
I really liked the Outcast exhibit that they had going on there. And so that was featuring some old medieval texts with the calligraphy and the drawings.
Yeah, we like to call it illuminated manuscripts.
Thank you. yes, illuminated manuscripts. And as somebody who went to Catholic school for many years and having seen these texts and held them with such high regard, it was kind of fun to see an exhibit ripping them apart.
Well, the exhibition was called Prejudice and Persecution in the Medieval World.
Yes.
And it showed how different people were sort of illustrated and mocked, et cetera. And including, there was one depiction of death that had a kind of a hook nose and was described in the caption as being kind of reflecting how Jews and Muslims are often portrayed in medieval manuscripts. And so...
Yeah, some of those were really interesting. I remember seeing one that had a depiction of a particular saint who was, I guess, known for being very generous to the poor and afflicted. And that was the main illustration on that page. But then in the margins of that illustration, they also showed a joust. This is a joust between two peasants wearing baskets on their heads. So it was supposed to be this ridiculous parody of an upper class activity being done by the foolish and embarrassing poor. So even in a text that was celebrating how this one saint was generous to the poor, they also thought it was good to throw in some mockery of pretty much the same people.
Yeah. There were lots of fun crazy.
Well, the thing that I found was kind of odd or interesting is that it's a fantastic plant. I mean, the facility is unbelievable.
You mean the Getty?
Yeah, the Getty itself.
Yeah.
And this is one person's fortune. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
It's unbelievably opulent. And yet, on the other hand, you're seeing this and you're saying, it's like I'm in the Met. It's like I'm in the Met. And then at a certain point, the collection's over. And you go, oh, I guess I'm not in the Met. because the Met is the Met. And you know, what could one person actually do? And it is really a fraction of the kind of volume and the kind of the number of artworks that you see in a Met. So even there are limitations in terms of a single person's fortune.
Well, how much did it cost to get in?
Nothing.
Okay, so admission is
free.
Is free.
Including a free tram ride.
And there is the tram ride.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, the design is very interesting. You go through a few rooms in chronological order, the art is. And then you may go across a terrace to another section and go through a few more
rooms. It's an elegant layout.
Yeah, it's very accessible in terms of attention span.
Right.
And
it definitely leads to League and Marvel.
So that was fun. So the Getty was a revelation. I'm glad I finally got there.
Okay, so the movie recommendation this week is not what you've been reading about in the paper, okay? It is instead, in other words, it's not A Wrinkle in Time. Instead, it's The Death of Stalin. The Death of Stalin. And you were saying you've never even heard of the movie.
Another young adult novel adaptation.
Exactly.
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, this goes back to the surprise travel.
Exact rival.
I mean, I read Wrinkle in Time when I was a kid, you know, and I would probably be leaning towards, you know, be even thinking.
And you buy a ticket, you enter the theater, and suddenly you're watching The Death of Stalin.
That's what's going to happen.
I have never thought I wanted to see a movie about Stalin.
Here's what's interesting about this. Without going into great detail, it's by a man named Armando Iannucci, who is known in some quarters because he is the originator of Veep, the HBO series, which is very popular. But in the Grabioff household, known even more for the reason that he is the artistic auteur of In the Loop. In the Loop, one of the funniest movies I have ever seen.
So he specializes in political humor.
Political humor, kind of rough political humor. They do say, by the way, The Death of Stalin is based on a graphic novel. Graphic novel, see, by Fabian Nuri and Terry Robin, which is hard to believe it's based on a graphic novel. But in any event, the Times gives a great review. They say it's a riot, or put in their own words, The Death of Stalin is by turns entertaining and unsettling, with laughs that morph into gasps and uneasy gasps that erupt into queasy, choking laughs. So
the headline is laugh until you bleed.
You'll laugh until you bleed. Everyone's into that, right?
This is very scary.
Okay. So
we'll be looking for that.
So The Death of Stalin. So there was an article that was kind of fascinating in the Times called No Magic Pill Will Get You to 100. So everyone's
that's disappointing.
It is a disappointing, actually. And that's part of the point, but they're calling it as they see it. Every once in a while you read about some kind of research being done. Yeah,
yeah,
you just do X. And very often when you read about that, you're reading about the individuals who are advocating that approach, who are following that approach themselves. I can't tell you how many times I've read articles about scientists saying, I eat very little or I eat just this plant or whatever.
Well, there was this thing about consuming no calories.
Right.
Like,
and so
it's very low calorie diet. And I watched a report about it. And the guy had all kinds of physical discomforts and had completely lost his libido.
Really?
Okay.
Well, it's a small price to pay.
So,
I know. If you call that living,
why?
I think it's the phrase. Yeah. But in any event, so here's we. But they have the names of these
folks. You
can't
call that living if no gal will give in to no man what's 900 years.
Yes, that was a quote about the Methuselah in Porgy and Bess, if I recall correctly. But in any event, Ira Gershwin, actually. Clive McKay. Clive McKay is one guy who had one of these low-calorie diets, all kinds of details, diet at the age of 69. Roy Walford, they give another example, diet at the age of 79. Fuel Gibbons, 64. Adele Davis, 70. It goes on and on and on.
Well, did promoting different things, or it was all about the low-calorie?
There are variations on the theme, but a lot of them were low-calorie-oriented. But
there's one line about, like, the two guys with opposing
right.
Nathan, dietary theories
right.
died at the same age.
Nathan Pritkin, one of the foremost champions of low-fat diets, died at 69. Robert Atkins, believed in the opposite regimen, died at the same age. Although I do think Robert Atkins suffered a fall, so I wonder about that one. But in any event, the outstanding example they give, or the most spectacular, is a fellow named Jerome Rodale, who was the founder of the publishing empire of that name. He was on the Dick Cavett show talking about how he was following a regimen described in the New York Times Magazine article about organic food to the extreme. He said he expected to live to be 100, and he was 72 at the time. And before the episode ended, he passed away. So that was an episode that never aired on the Dick Cavett
show. He died during the episode?
He just passed out in the middle of telling people he was going to live another 28 years, and he died.
Oh.
All right. So in any event.
Hubris.
Hubris is a separate problem. But the point is, there's no quick fix. There's no obvious solution for a singular person following a regimen. But what the Times points out, and I think this is fascinating, is yet the age expectancy, life expectancy, keeps going up substantially. And why? It's not because of approaches like this. It's because of public health measures. Because of public health measures, life expectancy over the last 100-some-odd years has gone up almost 30 years because of advances in public sanitation, clean water, and the control of infectious diseases. So they say if you're really interested in living longer, what you should be investing in is not personal regimens, but public health initiatives. And there's some logic to that.
All right.
So that's kind of interesting. So we had, there was an article about tech Poobahs visiting the heartland. Is that that
yes.
is
not to be confused with Tech Pooh Bears visiting the heartland.
That's a different article. That,
what are Poobahs? Are they like CEOs?
So, yeah, big time guys.
They're Maharajas.
Venture capitalists.
They're venture capitalists.
Clear.
Naturally, discipline comes from the welfare. Yes.
And they took a bus trip.
Yeah.
To America's Heartland, otherwise known as Akron, Ohio, Flint and Detroit, Michigan, and South Bend, Indiana. And it's almost kind of funny because it's kind of like these rich guys being like, wow, middle America is okay.
it does sound ridiculous, doesn't it?
It seems like they got on a bus and they said, imagine me on a bus.
But the bus also had vegan donuts.
Yeah, okay.
And,
I don't doubt that.
Kombucha, coal-infused kombucha.
Yeah.
And so by the end of it, they're all excited. And they're like, wow, it's so much cheaper here. And
the food is so much better in Akron.
The kombucha is extremely.
And they go on Zillow, and they're looking at real estate. And they're, you know, like, kind of dollar signs in their eyes. Like, wow, we could save so much money, and we could stop dealing with these pretentious programmers in Silicon Valley.
Right.
And
so there's life outside.
Well, I mean, it's pertinent because you two guys are tech exemplars. I mean, you're out there. And does this open your eyes now? You're saying flyover country is the place to be?
Well, since we're both 30 under 30 media luminaries, we can speak with great authority on this. But no, I mean, from the quotes in the article, I was not convinced these guys were going to follow through on anything. One of the quotes has this person saying, wow, this is so great. If it weren't for my kids, I would move here. So, which is another way of saying, I'm not moving.
It's the first time you said that.
And so I don't particularly believe that they're going to follow through. And I think there are lots of good reasons that they should follow through.
But
you know, it's still like an insular subculture, like any other, like tech in the kind of Silicon Valley area. People like to rail against it now and then, but I think a lot of times they still stay inside it. And some of the things that they complain about seem pretty ridiculous to me. Like, you know, they have a segment in the article talking about how annoying it is for them to deal with these Silicon Valley tech engineers who are such a problem if they don't get all these amenities. And, you know, these are people who even despite their great careers are not handling nearly the sums of money that these venture capitalists are. It's like, you know, they're kind of complaining about like, oh, the little people in my organization are so oppressive to me. It comes off as a little ridiculous. And they also cite Peter Thiel as someone who is moving out of Silicon Valley. And they say, oh, he's tired of the liberal echo chamber. So he moved to Los Angeles. It's all a little bit hard to take.
Well, right. Peter Thiel is ultra-conservative, if I recall correctly.
He is, but he still wants to live on the coast.
Well, he's a Renaissance man. So you had something about, this is an article that was very popular. Yesterday's News Today, Deep, Informed, Accurate, and Inky.
And Inky. So yes, this is about some fellow who decided he was going to get all his news from the newspaper. The actual newspaper, the actual print copy, not from any digital source. He's going to do this for a period of time as kind of an experiment.
Was this Dan Abula?
Well, no, I do that, but it's not my article.
No, it was not someone who is capable of getting the news from a digital source. This guy made a deliberate choice. I think he read just three papers. I think it was the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah.
So he basically says it was good, you know, that he just got good information and that this was superior to his previous media diet that included social media and various forms of, you know, TV and online punditry. And he thought this was better for him to be getting news that had been processed and, fact-checked and edited and brought to him at a slightly later date, but was all the better for it. I think this is pretty reasonable. It's a little bit funny that it's such a stunt for this guy to read newspapers and not use Twitter. It's generally reasonable. I'm someone who, like, a couple of years ago was using Twitter and, like, thought I got something out of it, but just eventually it just was less and less fun for me. And eventually I said, I'm going to stop using this, and found that I was no worse off. I was not less informed. I was not meaningfully less entertained. And so while I haven't gone as far as this guy, I feel like it's pretty reasonable to say, you should be skeptical of social media and, less serious, I guess, journalistic sources.
So we're rooting for slow news.
Slow news.
Slow food,
slow news. Yeah. It should be a new trend.
Reference to Michael Pollan.
Oh, that's true.
Michael Pollan says eat food, not too much.
Mostly plants.
Mostly plants. And so he breaks it down into three different pieces.
Yeah, he says,
as well.
What is it? Get news. I'm going to make some newspaper sounds so you know I'm looking this up. It's basically get news not too fast, not social media, something like that.
Well, the truth is, people, you don't have to know everything right away.
Yeah.
That's what it turns out. Sometimes it will keep, you do benefit probably by having somebody sit with it for a few minutes and maybe think about it and write about it in complete paragraphs and have an editor look at it and, it doesn't mean it's going to be completely unbiased, or it doesn't mean only one source is enough, but I think it's useful. All right, so we are going to close with an obituary. Roger Bannister died. I hate to really harp on Generation Divide, and yet here we have it. Roger Bannister, unknown perhaps to Zeke and Noel. So I'll explain. Roger Bannister was perhaps the best-known athlete of the 1950s and the early 1960s. And it's true. I mean, why? Because he broke the four-minute mile. It used to be a barrier that no human being could run the mile in under 4 minutes. Maybe track and field was a bigger competition then. Maybe more people followed it. But it was years and years and years people pursued, and they thought that there was no way a human being could run a four-minute mile. Roger Bannister ran the mile in 3 minutes, 59 seconds, and 4/10 seconds in 1954. And conditions were much different then. Athletes were different. He only trained 28 miles a week, which is Lilliputian compared to the way people train today. He was on a cinder track, which is not a fast track. He was wearing shoes, which would hardly be regarded as high-tech today. Science and nutrition, all that, everything very different. So by some people's lights, it was a monumental accomplishment, even though today the world record holder runs the mile in under 3 minutes and 50 seconds. That's 10 seconds faster. In other words, you would be only almost be 100 yards ahead of Roger Bannister if the two were racing somehow in the same universe.
But that's over 60 years.
It is over 60 years. And I'm telling you, Roger Bannister was extremely well known also because and this was more of the fashion at that time. He was a celebrity, but that's not what he did for a living. So in his late 20s, he quit and he said, okay, I can't devote all my time to this. I have to move on in life. And he became a neurologist and actually a well-known neurologist. And he just turned his back on it. And that was not so unusual then. You didn't make a career out of it. You did something else. You didn't go to Dancing with the Stars. You found a different career. Later, he was knighted. And he has a very interesting quote in his autobiography, which I think he wrote himself. But it's, whoever wrote it, it's beautifully written. And he describes the last few yards of breaking that barrier, the four-minute barrier. He said, those last few seconds seemed never ending. The faint line of the finishing tape stood ahead as a haven of peace after the struggle. The arms of the world were waiting to receive me. If only I reached the tape without slackening my speed. If I faltered, there would be no arms to hold me, and the world would be a cold, forbidding place because I had been so close. I leapt at the tape like a man taking his last spring to save himself from the chasm that threatens to engulf him. So, Roger Bannister. So that's all we have this week. So it was a great podcast.
Can I just give a shout out to Sadie, as long as we're talking about running?
Yes.
Who ran a half marathon in Washington.
And beat her
DC.
Best time by, we understand, three minutes. Which is,
wow.
All right.
Wow.
I want to see the drug tests on that that result.
Nice, Daniel. Nice.
We'll see. I said I'd see them. I'm not, no preconceived notions.
I don't know if the Advil is going to show up.
I'm not doing the test. So in any event, great podcast, and we're having a great time here. It's been a wonderful weekend. We're about to go out to dinner. And let's say Southern California's got a lot to say for it, don't you think?
Yeah.
And now it has Noel and Zeke to say for it, so not
all
much
right.
more.
All right,
okay.
So thank you, Noel and Zeke. And,
thank you.
This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Apioff.
And we'll see you next week.